From the KGOU studios, I'm Rebecca Cruz, filling in today for Suzette Gerlot, and welcome to Worldviews. University of Oklahoma political scientist Paul Good joins me to discuss Russian President Vladimir Putin's recent trip to Italy.
And so he used it to a certain extent as a podium to be able to put his case, to state Russia's case over and over again for what it's currently doing and what it's not doing, according to the Kremlin's version, in Ukraine.
Then we'll hear Suzette's conversation with journalist Barbara Slavin. They'll discuss what the ongoing nuclear talks mean for U.S.-Iranian relations and the possibility for diplomacy.
I don't think we're going to fall back into each other's arms and have the kind of relationship we had when the Shah of Iran was in power. But I see a kind of detente emerging.
The future of U.S.-Iranian relations coming up after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz. Welcome to the studio, Paul Good. Thank you for joining us for the roundtable. This week, we saw as the seven leaders of the G7 got together in Germany. Obviously missing is Russia, who was previously of the G8 and were unceremoniously perhaps kicked out last year due to actions in Ukraine. And then a couple days later, we noticed that Vladimir Putin is in Italy making a bit of a European tour. What are we to make of this? Coincidence, or is this a strategic trip on Putin's part?
I think it's partly strategic insofar as Putin likes to catch everybody looking in the right direction, although it also underlines the extent to which he's been excluded from the G7. And, you know, I don't know to what extent that actually was the intended message, but it did provide him with a platform to be able to speak out to those elements of the EU that are less supportive of sanctions. And he has for some time attempted to try to drive a wedge between EU members. And with EU sanctions against Russia up for renewal later this month, Putin perhaps hoped to be able to put a little bit extra pressure or at least sow some seeds of doubt in the minds of EU members as they started to contemplate whether or not to renew sanctions.
Well, interesting that he chose Italy. Of course, Italy's prime minister was at the G7 this week and did, along with the other members, claim that they would support sanctions. But then Putin made some pretty strong arguments for why Italy is such a great partner and how the sanctions against Russia have also negatively affected Italy. He then went to visit the Pope. So interesting strategy there.
Well, yes, he's tried to capitalize on the claim that, well, Russia has made from the beginning that the sanctions were essentially unprovoked, that Russia has always been acting in its own best interests and in the best interests of Ukraine. And of course, all roads in these conversations ultimately do lead back to Ukraine with regards to sanctions. In fact, when Putin, almost fresh off the plane, was interviewed by an Italian newspaper, he was asked initially about relations with Europe and then spent the next bulk of the interview actually talking about Ukraine instead. And so he used it to a certain extent as a podium to be able to put his case, to state Russia's case over and over again for what it's currently doing and what it's not doing, according to the Kremlin's version, in Ukraine. It also provided him with an opportunity to try to appeal to European pocketbooks to make it clear that sanctions, as well as not only the EU sanctions, but as well as Russia's counter-sanctions, are impacting budgets, especially in Italy, which is particularly sensitive right now to these kinds of issues. Italy, of course, along with Spain and to a lesser extent Germany, have been really kind of hesitant to ratchet up the pressure on Russia any further. And so this is one way of sort of working the weak points, as it were, in the EU's armor. Even though he made the Pope wait for an hour before he could talk with him.
Who lets the Pope wait?
Given Putin's legendary lateness for things, all things, this was actually a sign of respect in some ways, or at least that's how one could spin it, I suppose. But speaking with the Pope provided Putin with an opportunity to demonstrate his credentials as somebody who can reach across faiths, who can speak to general interests. And of course, it also provided him potentially with an ability to reach audiences that otherwise would not be willing to listen to him, particularly in Poland and in Lithuania, where you have a very heavy presence, of course, of Catholics, and possibly even in Western Ukraine, even though that seems less likely.
Right. And the Pope has received some criticism, particularly from Catholics in the region you mentioned and in Ukraine, where there are many, for not taking a firmer stance with Putin on this issue. Are there other countries, other leaders, maybe not in the G7, that might be willing to not vote for renewed sanctions?
Well, the Russian government has been working with a variety of different parties across Europe as a way of sort of expanding his base of potential support. There was a very public gathering of far-right parties from Europe in St. Petersburg not long ago, earlier this year. Putin has also helped to rally some of the old left in Europe that has traditionally been opposed to NATO and especially American influence in Europe. It doesn't always sell, though, as well as one might have hoped, in part because Russia has already announced that it's pivoting its economy away from Europe and towards Asia. And so as much as it wants to try to maintain the current economic relations it has with these partners and sources of political influence and to claim a common European intellectual legacy, it doesn't appear to be in the cards for the, as far as a long-term strategy goes.
Well, I'm sure we will continue to watch and see what Putin does next. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
If you'd like to share your thoughts about this conversation, you can join the discussion by leaving a comment on the Worldviews page of KGOU.org, where you can also listen to past episodes of the show. You can also send us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU. After a short break, we'll hear Suzette Krilat's conversation with journalist Barbara Slavin. They'll discuss the United States' relationship with Iran and whether or not tension is starting to ease between the two countries. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, in today for Suzette Grelot. This half hour, we're going to hear Suzette's conversation with Barbara Slavin. She's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council South Asia Center and the Washington correspondent for the Middle East news site AlMonitor.com. Throughout her career as a journalist, Slavin has covered terrorism, the Iran-Iraq war, and the Arab-Israeli conflict. She's a regular commentator on U.S. foreign policy and Iran for NPR, PBS, and C-SPAN. She also served as a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, where she researched and wrote about Iran's influence in the Middle East. Her 2007 book, Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, chronicles the complicated history of U.S.-Iran relations and traces U.S. policy, which she argues has led to hostility between the two countries.
Barbara Slavin, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much.
So, Barbara, I'm going to get into some details about the U.S.-Iranian relationship, but I've noticed that in your career as a journalist, you have traveled to Iran many times, and this is something that many of us cannot do or won't do. Some might say wouldn't travel to Iran, but you've been many times, nine times, and most recently you went to cover the inauguration of President Rouhani. So can you just give us a sense as an American citizen who's not, you know, for the most of us that don't travel there, we only know what we know about Iran from the media, and things that we read and see on TV. What's it like in Iran?
Well, you know, obviously it's hard to generalize about a country of almost 80 million people and so on. But I have to say that in my trips there, by and large, I've met with a very positive reception as an American. We are still a little bit forbidden fruit because there have been no diplomatic relations between the United States and Iran since 1980. So not very many Americans go. And the ones who do go, as I say, usually are received very well. Not all the time. There are certain elements in Iran that don't particularly like the United States, but ordinary people tend to be extremely welcoming. There's a line that I like that was actually used by a former CIA director, Mike Hayden. He said that the Iranians are the most pro-American Muslim population from Marrakesh in Morocco to Bangladesh. And I think that is absolutely true. In my trips there, the most positive reception I got was actually after the attacks of 9/11. I went in December 2001, and Iranians really sympathized with the United States in a way that Muslim populations in other parts of the world did not. So that was quite striking.
Well, this is really interesting to hear that they're very pro-American, the population very pro-American, positive reception. I mean, you hear this sometimes, you know, that the U.S. and Iran are really actually on the same side of many issues. They actually have a lot in common. But it seems like there's still a very difficult relationship between the two. And in fact, you've written a book in the past about this issue, about this very kind of convoluted relationship and you know, contradictory, in fact, policies that the United States has toward Iran. So how do we make sense of that, that your experience on the ground versus, you know, what we see from a distance?
Well, look, there's the people and then there's the government. The government has an official ideology which is hostile to the United States. They call the United States the Great Satan. They chant death to America, you know, at various official celebrations, shall we say. Right now we're in a period where Iran is marking the anniversary of the 1979 revolution, and they will have a big rally on February the 11th where people will chant death to America, you know, but don't take it personally, right? In my book, actually I write in the first chapter, which is called Death to America and Can I Have Your Autograph, about an experience that I think really captures the kind of schism between ordinary Iranians and the official rhetoric. I was there in 2006 to cover this big rally on February 11th, the culmination of the revolution when the last prime minister of the former Shah of Iran resigned in 1979. And I was there and I was on a sort of platform with all the other foreign journalists. And even though sometimes I can pass for Iranian, it was pretty clear, I guess, the way I was wearing my headscarf, something about my clothing, that I was an Iranian. And there were a bunch of schoolgirls there who were, you know, chanting death to America and wearing these placards saying nuclear energy is our national right. But one of them came over to me and she said, where are you from? And I said, I'm from America. I'm from America. And she got so excited. And this huge group of girls, maybe 13, 14-year-old girls, started ripping little pieces of paper out of their notebooks and passing them to me and asking for my autograph, which I thought was hysterical since I'm not exactly famous, but they were just so thrilled that somebody from the United States was there in Tehran on this day and that they had a chance to meet an American and exchange names with an American. So the desire for a better relationship is there. In terms of the government, I think one of the things that's held us back is that there's been a competition between political factions in Iran as to which faction would get the credit for finally having a breakthrough with the United States and easing this this hostility.
Well, I do think it's remarkable what you've described here is, you know, in my own experience as well, when you go certain places of the world where people love Americans, but they don't necessarily love the U.S. government or certainly U.S. foreign policy. And so that's, I think, where this disconnect comes from. Mm-hmm. And in the case of your work, where you talk about contradictions in particular, I think that's the thing that's awfully hard for our partners around the world to swallow, or potential enemies or friends, you know, is that we are contradictory in our relationship. I mean, I imagine we're not the only ones. Other countries do the same thing. But what specifically in U.S. foreign policy is contradictory toward Iran that would create or at least contribute to this type of relationship?
Well, I think a lot of it, you know, there have been mistakes certainly made on both sides and grievous harm that has been done to both sides. The U.S. supported Saddam Hussein in the 1980s against Iran in the Iran-Iraq War. This is something that most Iranians will never forget. The CIA helped overthrow Prime Minister Mossadegh back in 1953. You know, there are a lot of grievances. On the other side, Iran has supported groups that have killed Americans in Lebanon and in Iraq, things that, of course, we won't forget. But the mistakes that have been made, I mean, I look at a couple of points, certainly in my book. In 1995-96, when Clinton was the president and Rafsanjani was the president in Iran, the Iranians made a lot of efforts to improve the relationship. They awarded a big oil contract to a company called Conoco. And Bill Clinton, under pressure from the Republican-led Congress, does this sound familiar, not only rejected the contract but put a total embargo on U.S. trade and investment with Iran and signed into law something called the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act at the time, which sought to penalize foreign companies that invested in Iran's petroleum sector. I think it was a big mistake, but it was done under pressure from Israel at the time. If you fast forward to 2001, again, it was a confluence of interests. The Iranians were on the same side with the United States and actually helped to get rid of the Taliban government in Afghanistan. But President Bush decided to put Iran on the axis of evil in a speech that he gave in 2002. Again, some pressure from Israel. There had been the discovery of a ship that had weapons for the Palestinians, allegedly from Iran. And Bush decided that he was going to go after all terrorism of global reach. That was the phrase that he used at the time, not distinguishing between Sunni fundamentalists who had been responsible for the attack on the United States during 9/11 and Iran, which had nothing to do with 9/11 and, as I mentioned, was actually opposed to these groups. Remember, the hijackers were primarily from Saudi Arabia, Egypt, United Arab Emirates. Not from Iran. I think most Americans don't realize that. So he put Iran on the axis of evil. He rejected a variety of overtures from the then government of President Khatami, who was a relative moderate and reformer in the Iranian political scheme. And as a result, we got Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Mr. Denial of the Holocaust, Mr. Wipe Israel off the map, someone far worse. And the Iranians accelerated their nuclear program. I mean, if Bush had not done what he'd done, it's possible Iran would never have gotten to the point that it's gotten with 20,000 centrifuges installed. It could have been perhaps contained at a much lower number. So, you know, mistakes on both sides, obviously. Then in Iraq, the United States went in, got rid of Saddam Hussein, essentially delivered Iraq to Iranian influence, but wouldn't cooperate with Iran during this period. So Iran became an adversary of the United States in Iraq. You know, these are things that we have to remember when we look at the picture now.
That's Barbara Slavin, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council South Asia Center and the Washington correspondent for the Middle East news site AlMonitor.com, speaking with Suzette Grelot. We'll get back to their conversation about the relationship between the United States and Iran after a short break. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, the Assistant Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, sitting in today for Suzette Grelot. We've been listening to Suzette's conversation with Barbara Slavin, a journalist who has spent much of her career covering stories from the Middle East, as well as U.S. policy towards Iran. When we left off, she described policy decisions by the Clinton and Bush administrations, which she says contributed to tensions between the two countries.
You've mentioned Israel a couple of times here, and I think it's worth asking this question. You know, obviously the United States and Israel are very close friends and allies. The title of your book about U.S.-Iran relationship, Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies. I mean, this kind of reminds me of that whole concept of frenemies, right? That you're,
sure.
You know, you're part friends, but part enemies. Is it ever going to be possible, you think, to move that from that frenemy to the more friend stage with Iran, given our very close relationship with Israel? I mean, Iran and Israel are not always opposed to everything, but they don't, at least on the surface, want to show that. So how does this, like, I don't know, for lack of a better word, love triangle or lack of love triangle, I mean, this relationship between the three hinder the relationships between the two?
Sure.
I don't
think it's a question of giving up our old alliances at all. I think that a better U.S.-Iran relationship would actually help Israeli interests. And there are a number of very thoughtful Israelis who admit this. Not so many in Saudi Arabia, but even some in Saudi Arabia. The United States needs options in the region. We have been dealing with the Middle East with a hand tied behind our back because of the lack of the relationship with the Iranians and the need to rely on, you know, Israeli and Saudi and other points of view. Already, I think we've seen, and this is, you know, I'm giving a talk about a truce, not a breakthrough with Iran. Already we've seen that thanks to these nuclear negotiations, the United States and Iran have reached a point where they can discuss not only those issues but also Iraq to some extent, Syria, other issues, the Islamic State, because we've had under President Rouhani, a kind of paradigm shift in terms of the contacts. We now have nearly daily contacts between the U.S. and Iran on a very high diplomatic level. Their foreign minister, Javad Zarif, our Secretary of State, John Kerry, meet regularly, are on a first-name basis. And this is unheard of. This would have been taboo just a few years ago, particularly from the Iranian side. So we've already, made some important changes here. You can sort of feel the tectonic plates of the region shifting. And that makes people who are wedded to the old status quo very, very nervous. You know, they are worried that the United States and Iran will find that they have some things in common and perhaps begin to move in certain directions that will disappoint or upset some of our traditional allies. We see that Benjamin Netanyahu, who's preparing to come to the United States to address a joint session of Congress, is vehemently opposed to the nuclear agreement that appears to be taking shape between the U.S. and Iran. And he has his reasons for being concerned, but, I personally do not see an alternative to a diplomatic deal that will serve American interests or really the interests of Israel in the end. I think a diplomatic deal is the only way to reliably prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons for another decade or so. You know, there are no other ways to do that. So it's difficult for people to adjust, and it's certainly appropriate for them to have concerns and express those concerns. But as an American, I want my government to have more options in the region.
So moving forward then into the future, what would you expect given what you're seeing? I mean, you're talking about these tectonic plates shifting and what already appears to be, at least in some way, warmer relations. Do we expect that to continue? Do you expect that that will normalize our relationship in some way with over the next generation, maybe? I mean, mm-hmm. I'm asking you to be a fortune teller here.
Sure.
You know, is that the expectation, that we would go in that direction as opposed to down that path of more difficult and perhaps even violent relations with Iran?
Well, I was a Soviet specialist. That's how I got my start in this business. And what I see is a kind of détente emerging. I don't think we're going to fall back into each other's arms and have the kind of relationship we had when the Shah of Iran was in power. But I see a kind of détente, which includes an ability to talk to each other on a more regular basis. Hopefully, at some point, American diplomats going back into Iran. That's a big, big step, and I wouldn't expect that to happen, that quickly, but I think ultimately it could. There are generational changes going on in Iran. The supreme leader of the country, Ayatollah Khamenei, will not be there forever. Certainly the vast majority of Iranians, particularly the younger generation, would like to see this relationship improve. Iranians who are thoughtful, strategic thinkers in that country want options also, just like the United States does. And they understand that isolating themselves from the United States has not served their interests very well, and that Iran wants to be back in the thick of things. They want to be out from under this pariah status, UN Security Council resolutions and so on. So there is a mutual benefit here. There is a win-win, as the Iranians like to say, solution to this. But of course we will continue to have disagreements with them, as we do, unfortunately, even more than we did in the past with Russia these days over Ukraine, as we do with China. There are a lot of countries that we have relationships with, but, it's not always sweetness and light.
Well, Barbara, thank you so much for joining us today and shedding some light on this very complicated relationship. It's very helpful for us. Thank you.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Suzette Gerlot's conversation with Barbara Slavin, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council South Asia Center who has spent her career covering the Middle East and U.S. policy towards that region. World Views is a collaborative partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Symphony Swift directs our research and books our guest, and Sam Dupre writes our digital content and produces the show with oversight from Brian Hardzinski. For Paul Good and Suzette Gerlot, I'm Rebecca Cruz.